get into the film in a little bit more detail again. So we'll not go scene by scene, but we'll go through some of the highlights that we picked out along the way. So the film opens with Josh, the young Josh. He's playing a computer game. It's like a graphic text adventure game. Interestingly, this game was completely made up. It was created for the film, never existed in real life. And for those interested, it's called The Cavern of the Evil Wizard. Now, the very first note that I wrote in my notebook, Josh is a very, very slow typer, that's to be said. He even has to say it out loud when he's typing as well, but he's a very slow typer. I just hope that when he gets older, he doesn't get a job in data entry or something like that, because he wouldn't be suited to it at all.
One of my first jobs was data entry, Andy. I was typing in paper copy, you know, the information on paper copies from fishing licenses into the computer, and I was tapping away a lot faster than Josh, to be honest.
We'll not talk about previous jobs on this podcast for various reasons.
Yes, moving on swiftly. So later we see Josh push his way through the queue to get close to the girl he fancies. But unfortunately for Josh, the girl is with an older boy and she mentions that he can drive. And to make matters worse, Josh is too small for the carnival ride.
Yeah, this is a good opening scene. I made a couple of notes here. One is that there's bad fashion everywhere. He's really awkward around the girls. His parents are embarrassing. It's just a typical childhood, isn't it? That's just what 12-year-old boys go through. And my other note, to your point earlier, the older boy that she's with drives a car. This girl's a foot taller than he is. And he thinks he has a chance with her. Really? Yeah, good luck with that kid.
Because, you know, does it ever mention how old she is? Because I don't think it does. You know when he sees...
I don't think it does, no.
Yeah, because he sees her with Billy on the street outside the shop. But I don't think it's ever mentioned that they're like in the same class or anything. Because if they were, and she was 12, then it's obviously very worrying that her boyfriend drives a car. So you got to make the assumption she's older than Josh.
Yeah, but then why would she pay him any attention at all? Because she seemed to know who he was.
Indeed, yeah.
There's strange things going on in this town.
Well, strange things happening with things like this in the 80s, as we know, don't we? So moving on, this prompts Josh to make a wish at the Zolta fortune teller machine Andy recalled earlier. And we actually find out after he does his wish that he's not actually plugged in. So, you know, a bit of magic there already. And Josh wishes to be big. And later on, after a stormy night, Josh gets his wish. And Andy, just before I move on, you know, when he makes the wish of being big, I just think of big as in more round and not necessarily tall. So I thought it should be called tall. And not big, because knowing my luck, it'd be like, I'll wake up as a kid and, well, I'll be like what I am now. And, you know, as a kid, you do not want
stone
to...
heavier. Yeah.
As a kid, you don't want to be
tall, you're still
this.
12. but now you're one of the fat kids. So not only are you not getting the girl because she's got a boyfriend who drives a car, but now the kids are picking on you for being fat in the playground as well.
That'd be my luck. But yeah, that was the thing that came to mind during that bit.
Yeah, they could have specified in the title that he wishes to be an adult version of himself. It's not quite the snappy title though, is it? But you're right, it's a stormy night, he gets his wish, and when he finds out the next morning, it's a really, really good scene in terms of the reveal. You know, he puts his legs out of the edge of the bunk bed and jumps down and goes to the bathroom. He's still sleepy, so he's not realized what's going on yet, and sees himself in the mirror, and it freaks him out. And then he starts, like, you know, doing a double take, splashes his eyes. I think he even looks down his pants, doesn't he, to see if everything is big. What I thought was this was really, really well acted by Hanks. Obviously, he's playing the part of a child, so he's acting very childlike. And I don't know, just a really, really powerful opening scene from Hanks, I thought. Question I did have, though, did you think the Hulk might have had the same reaction the very first time he grew? I know it's not the same scenario, but just thinking about the very first time he hulked up.
I think it's an interesting question there, Andy, because during that scene, I thought of the Hulk as well. So it's strange that me and you both said the same thing, but my thought was, You know, when he goes back into the bedroom to pull on his jeans, I then started thinking about the whole, you know, how whenever he gets angry, but he always keeps his, like, the waistline the same, but his clothes are kind of, like, ripped. And that's where it brought to mind. But I wonder, yeah, I don't think the Hulk would have checked down his trousers there. I think he would have just went on and smashed things up. But no, I agree. It's very well done there. And Hank seems to just nail the whole being a child in an adult's body throughout this film. We then have a clip where Hanks is trying to put on the old pair of jeans, as I just mentioned. And when I say old, obviously they potentially could not be old, but as in old, as in 12-year-old size old, not, you know, they could have been brand new the day before. But he ends up borrowing some of his dad's clothes as well, and then he heads into the city after meeting Billy at the basketball practice.
Yeah, so he goes to this pretty dodgy hotel, it has to be said, because obviously his mum doesn't recognise him. You know, he can't live in the house because she's thinking there's a strange guy in the house. So he's on his own now. He's got whatever money that Billy could muster together for him. He's at this dodgy hotel, and there's gunfire outside. TV's heavily chained to the wall, and then Billy obviously has to go home, so he leaves Josh alone for the night. But then he's got to travel back on his own as well from the city quite late at night. I think he mentioned that he's got a 10 p.m. curfew or something, which is quite late for a 12-year-old, isn't it?
Especially in the city, and he's got to get back to the suburbs. That was Josh is obviously an adult, and Billy's took Josh there. So Josh is, I think you've commented later on where he said he's 3 months older. So those 3 months are massive, that he's, you know, gone to the city with his friend, made sure he's safe, and now he's going to commute back home all on his own. And we see that Josh is upset in his new surroundings here as well.
Yeah, it's all a bit much for him, isn't it? He's a scared, lonely boy trapped in an adult's body. And again, I thought this was really, really well acted by Hanks. This is a different scene from what we saw earlier in terms of the emotion that it's portraying. So he's really showing his range already, Hanks is. He's well worth that money they've spent on him.
Yeah, definitely worth the $2 million. Now, later on, we find out it's going to take roughly 6 weeks, if not more, for them to receive the information about the carnival locations. And little note here, Andy, I've made, there's obviously no Google then, or other search engines, obviously, are available. And this is where I noticed my wife was falling asleep for the first time. So I don't know what it's like, Andy, with your wife or people, you know, listeners out there with their partners. You know, when you watch a film or a TV program, you just know sometimes that your partner is going to go asleep. Because I turned around when we first started watching this, she'd lay down on the sofa, she got a pillow, she got a blanket all over her. So it's like she was settling down to sleep. And I said, no, are you not watching this? She said, yeah, I'm going to watch it. Yeah, I'm going to watch it. And then, like, this is when I turned around and she was, like, dropping off. So I don't know what minute this would be in a film, but it's early doors, isn't it?
Yeah, we're barely getting started, and I completely know what you're talking about. You know, usually the recliner goes up, blanket goes on. Like, this is the, you know, the international sign of sleepy time. So it always happens. So, but Josh, he's a grown-up now. He needs to pay his way, so he goes and gets himself a job interview. And we see Susan for the first time, and he's checking her out in the interview, being pretty obvious about it as well. Obviously, he doesn't realise how to be subtle yet. And then we find out he gets the job straight there and then. If only it was that easy. And then later on, we see him at work, first day on the job, and he bumps into her as he's walking to the printer. They both kind of bend down to pick the papers up. And he blatantly looks down atop to see a hint of bra. I've made the note here, horny teenager alert.
Indeed, horny teenager alert. I wonder when men, boys, grow out of that. Or if we ever do, Andy.
I'll let you know, it's not happened yet.
See, I wasn't going to say anything there, Andy, just in case my wife listened to the podcast episode. So I'm all innocent now. And now you've just landed yourself in hot water.
Yeah, but I'm editing this episode, so you never know what you might say.
Are you going to be like when you see those films where you're taking parts of word or my words from different sentences and you're just going to drop it in there? So I'm like the guilty one.
It's like that South Park episode after Isaac Hayes had left and they still kept Chef in and they just played clips of his voice from previous episodes and just mashed them together as if he was playing a part in that episode.
We see Josh phone his mum and explain that Josh is okay. Now, my note here, Andy, is this is a strange scene because I can't imagine how they would do this today. And I don't know if it's weird back in the day when they made this, because later on, you know, we're going to mention it. There's only one thing really that is kind of alluded to about a child being missing. So you don't see much about Josh being missing, do you, from the film? So I thought this was a bit strange that he phoned, because I assume in those days would have been able to track phone calls, but I guess maybe not. Who knows?
Is this one of those things like you see in some of the older films where they have to be on the line for so long before they can trace it? One of those kind of things. But, I mean, in this case, she's just on her own. There's no police around. So any investigation about a missing person is not really alluded to in the film. And I guess I understand why, because they want to keep it quite light. But in the background, there's a sinister undertone. It probably changes the whole dynamic of the film, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, it'd be interesting to see if they ever remade this film, how they would get around that, or did they just gloss over it like they've done in this version. Anyway, so we see Tom Hanks. He's just got accustomed to adult life now. It's easy being an adult, isn't it?
He does seem to be taking it all in his stride. I think there's a scene where he gets his first paycheck for $187 for the week, which, interestingly, I will work this out. I didn't write it in the notes, but that'd be $479 in today's money. So that's not bad for a week's work. But he's wandering around the toy store. I think this must be the weekend. And he bumps into his boss while he's wandering around, and they have a bit of a wander around together, and he's got loads of opinions to share on the toys and what's wrong with them and why he doesn't like anything in there. And his boss says something along the lines of, you know, these are the kind of things you don't see in a marketing report, or something along those lines. And Josh's response is, what's a marketing report? And Macmillan just goes, exactly.
That is a good interaction, Andy. And I think it's good that you picked that out. I think try that in one of your conversations at work, Andy, when your boss says something and just turn around and just say something similar and see if you get, you know, exactly, and the promotion as well.
Yeah, all laughed out of the room. That's what would likely happen.
People just look at you silly when you ask what an acronym is. Like, you know, when someone just drops an acronym that you've not heard of, or an acronym that could be like three or four different things.
I like to sometimes give people the thing like, this needs a TLA. And people are like, what's a TLA? Oh, it's a three-letter acronym.
I like that. I've not heard that one before. And moving on, so this is the scene, like Andy said, it's iconic, and it's one of the scenes that I remembered. It's the famous big scene in terms of the floor piano. I don't know if that's the correct name. It's what I've named it, the floor piano. Now, this little scene and the interaction with Macmillan about marketing report, etc., helps Hanks get a promotion to vice president. And he's got to play with lots of different toys and test toys. So this definitely seems a dream job for Hanks and any child that turns into an adult overnight.
Oh yeah, getting paid massive amounts of money to just sit around and play with toys. That is a dream for anyone. It's so high up the company, he's even got his own assistant now, Miss Patterson. And I noted that she seems really miserable. Like, she doesn't like being an assistant, you can tell. But it's probably not helped by the fact that Josh is being a bit of a douchebag, isn't he? Like, asking her for drinks or whatever. And then, what did he ask for? Like, a copy of the Super Bowl with the adverts taken out or something ridiculous. Like, what a dick.
Yeah, it's Super Bowl or Stanley Cup or something, wasn't it? And it's just silly. And this is the scene now coming up where I kind of alluded to earlier. So it's a short scene between Susan and Paul, isn't it? Where you see the milk carton and it's the photo of young Josh. So in America, I don't know if you do it in the UK. In America, I believe you have, you know, the milk cartons with the missing person photo. So I don't know if I've ever seen it over here, Andy.
I can't say I've paid that much attention to the milk, but I'm going to assume not. But it certainly does seem to be quite a well-known thing in the US. Just seems very strange that the first place you'd look would be a milk carton to see who's missing today.
Yeah.
Not a newspaper or the internet or something, but yeah, very, very odd. Following on from there, we see a scene in a business meeting. Paul's there. He's presenting this new toy idea. And Hank starts talking about this robot bug, and everyone is lapping it up, and you can tell Paul's really annoyed because he's just basically taken over the meeting. But I made a note in my pad, and he basically, the thing that starts it all off is Paul's gone through his pitch and everyone seems happy, and Josh just goes, "I don't get it." And you could tell like the frustration on Paul's face. Like, what do you mean you don't get it? It's like, well, I don't get it. It's like it's a building and it's a robot. And then it goes into this whole thing, and that's how he gets onto the toy. And all of a sudden, the whole meeting's turned on its head, and it's all about Josh and not about Paul.
Yeah, and he's talking, and I don't know about the time frame, but he's basically talking about Transformers, but, you know, the insect type of Transformers. So I don't know, because at the time of recording this, there's going to be a Transformer film come out over the next few months. And it's basically Transformers that are, I think it's dinosaurs or bugs. So it'd be interesting to see whether there was a Transformer that was an insect before this film, or if it's this kind of scene that kind of influenced that line of Transformers.
Yeah, who stole from who?
Yes, yeah. Kind of like the chicken and egg situation, Andy.
Yeah.
Moving on, we've got... Sorry, Andy. That just had to stop you there, Andy, because I know you've got another point here. This is another bit where I've turned around and the wife is falling asleep again. So every time I see her fall asleep, I just kind of like do this thing. It winds her up because she could be laid there or sat there. And what I do is I try to slowly move my body to look in her eyes to see if she's awake. And if she is awake, she just like snaps at me going, like, "I'm awake, I'm watching it." But because she wears glasses, you can't tell her eyes are open. So I'm kind of doing this kind of like creepy look at her. Anyway, so she was falling asleep. But after this point, Andy, she did start watching the film. I think she repositioned herself, maybe made a cup of tea, but she stopped laying around, laying down. So from this point onwards, I'd say that she's kind of snapped out and she's got a bit more interested.
So only after you woke her up for the second time did she give her full attention to this.
She's joining me on this journey, Andy. If she wants to or not.
A journey it certainly is. But let's go back to the journey of this film. So we've got Josh and Billy in Josh's new apartment. He's got loads of funky stuff in there. They've got a basketball net and arcade machines, loads and loads of toys. This is a pretty cool life that he's living, has to be said. Later on, we see a scene where he goes to a work party of sorts. I don't know if it's Christmas or whether it's just a corporate shindig, but it's clearly a black tie affair. Everyone's in their tuxedos and ball gowns or whatever the female equivalent is. Gowns of some sort. Apologies for my lack of terminology. I don't go to many of these kind of things. I've only wore a tuxedo once in my entire life. But the tuxedo that Josh is wearing is pretty special, has to be said. It's kind of, is it pink or yellow? I'm trying to remember the colour. Pink or maybe white, and it's kind of like a long tail suit, very frilly, very out there. And the way he appears and without a care in the world, he doesn't realise what he's done wrong here. But the boss doesn't seem to mind, does he?
No, and it's white, isn't it? But it has lots of detail on, which I can't remember if it was like gold or a different kind of...
Yeah, that like, sounds right. I had pink in my head for some reason. I may be thinking of Dumb and Dumber.
But yeah, you're right. He's definitely rocking something unconventional there. And you can't blame him. You don't want to be a sheep, do you? So we have a funny scene now with Josh and Susan in a limo. And like Andy mentioned earlier about Hank's kind of nailing, you know, kind of like the child mannerisms and stuff like that. And this is brilliantly done because it captures everything when a child is kind of exposed to something new and exciting. So he's in a limo. It's probably the first limo he's ever been into. And he's touching all the different buttons, messing around. He puts his head through the sunroof as well. And it's just really well done on this. And he's even getting some fries as well.
Yeah, it's a really good scene. And then it leads to them going back up to his flat because Susan mentioned that she wants to see where he stays. And again, it's just the innocence of it all is what makes it. And they're outside his front door, and basically she hints that maybe she wants to come in. And he says, and I wrote this quote down. It was, "Do you mean a sleepover? Okay, but I get to be on top." And, you know, obviously that means a couple of different things there, but he's completely clueless as to the innuendo there. But, you know, they go inside and Susan's a bit taken aback by what she sees, but she slowly starts to get into things. And when they're on the trampoline together, that's when she really starts to relax a little bit.
Yeah, I think it is a good throwaway comment there. And that is good because she's slowly kind of like forming out, isn't she? So I just wanted a quick shout out there, Andy, because they've got Thundercats bed sheets. And Thundercats is a cartoon that I watched as a kid, Andy. I wasn't in my 20s with this one. I was a kid when I watched Thundercats. But also, actually, they've... oh, no, that's He-Man. I'm going to say they've redone Thundercats, but they've redone He-Man on Netflix. So, yeah, Thundercats I used to watch. Now, we also have a birthday meal. So at the beginning, Josh was 12. Now he's 13. The, you know, a year makes a big difference there. And he's in like an Italian restaurant from memory. And he's out with Billy. But Josh has to turn down Billy's kind of like play date. Because he's got a real date with Susan. And Josh, he doesn't notice, as part of this date that he goes to, he doesn't notice the Soltar machine is there as well. So the film could have ended then, and he could have made his wish. So, he's happy.
Yeah, there's obviously other things on his mind these days. Later on, we see a scene with Paul and Susan, and they're having a discussion/argument about Josh. And I think it kind of intimates that they used to date because she's bringing his stuff back. And Paul asks her, "What's so special about Baskin?" And her reply is, "He's a grown-up," which is a nice line, considering the context of the film. Later on, Josh and Billy, Billy's trying to get his friend back, but Josh just seems to have forgotten that element of his life. It's almost like he's moved on, so their relationship is quite strained now. And they have a bit of a bust-up in Josh's office. And the quote here, I may have to bleep one of the words of this, but the quote is, "I'm your best friend. What's more important than that? And I'm 3 months older than you, a-hole."
Yeah, it's a good scene. 3 months at that age does make a big difference. Now, Andy, I just want to pause for a minute because this scene prompted a discussion. So, like I said, my wife is awake now. And... this prompted a discussion, and I was a bit surprised. So what I asked her was, if she was in this situation, what would she do? You know, would she want to go back and find the Soltar machine and go back to being a kid, or would she stay where she was? Now, she surprised me because she said she'd stay as the adult version of Josh. And I said, like, why? She said, oh, because he's, like, successful. He's got a blossoming relationship as well. So I wonder, if I pose that question to you, Andy, what would you do? Would you go back as a, you know, to a 13-year-old self, or would you stay as a 30-year-old man?
Yes, an interesting question, this. I would say, logically, I would take the learnings from my time as an adult and then take them to childhood, so then that would make me better prepared. But on the flip side, being a teenager can be pretty sucky at times. So, you know, maybe you want to skip some of that. So I'm on the fence. I'm not going to say either way, but there's pros and cons to either argument.
Yeah, I think if you were going back, you could do what they did in Back to the Future. I think it's Biff, you know, where you got all the betting book and all the results from, I don't know if it was a horse racing or dogs or whatever. But for me, it's like you're giving up 20 years of your life in terms of what the unknown. I mean, you could go for those 20 years and be like a dropout and a failure, but you've got those 20 years of experience that you can, you know, go through everything, you know, your first kiss again and all the other things. But I know what you mean, being a teenager is sucky. And I always say to my kids, you know, I don't know what it was like when you were growing up. My parents used to always say to me, being a child is the best years of your life, which I think is, I completely disagree with. I think now, you know, as you know, our age, Andy, I think it's a good time because you can do what you want, you can eat what you want, and you're not being dictated to. So when my kids are saying, oh, you know, school's rubbish and stuff like that, I don't say that, oh, this is the best years of your life. I say, you know, you got to do your work now, and you can have all those better years where you can, like, have as many takeaways as you want in a week. You can go to bed, you can binge, you know, Netflix or Amazon or whatever.
I have to agree. I do not want to go back to my childhood days. I maybe want to go back a few years to, like, my 20s because my body's breaking down and I'm getting older and fatter, but I definitely don't want to go back any further than that. Let's start to wrap things up on this section because we're approaching the end of the film now. We see an emotional scene between Josh and Susan at the pier, and because, you know, at this point he's told her that he's a kid and she thinks he's crazy and, you know, he's starting to miss his old life. So he goes back to the pier, finds the machine, the Zoltar machine, and, you know, makes his wish that he wants to go back to how things were. And there's a funny interaction between the two when she asks how old he really is and he says, I'm 13. And she just kind of rolls her eyes and goes, well, that explains it.
Indeed. Yes. If this was a more serious film, I think she'd probably be mortified, you know, because it's a bit lighthearted. I think that kind of sums it up.
Our discussion here would not be about the funny interaction. It would be, Susan is definitely a paedophile.
I wonder if there's like a sequel or some like a scene after the credits like they do in Marvel films where Josh is 13 but he just turns up at her apartment. It's like expecting the things carrying on. But we're at the end now, so we get a sweet ending. I think it's a sweet ending, and we see Josh walking down the street to his parents' house, and Susan's watching on, and obviously she looks down in the car for some reason, and when she looks up, he's a child again. And that's a scene that I remembered before watching that. I think that's very well done. And that's the end of the film, Andy.
Yeah, good way to end. We've come full circle. He's got his childhood back. And everyone lives happily ever after, except Susan, who has to live with the guilt of being technically a paedophile.
She must have gone to therapy.
Yeah, her life spirals from this point onwards, and the spin-off is a much darker place.
The Rain Room. So, moving on, we're going to talk about the film now for a bit. The film opens and closes with a memorable score and a simple white feather floating through the air.
Yeah, this was a really beautiful scene. It's all about the music, really, wasn't it? And the score. And I'm assuming, and I could be wrong, but I'm assuming that American Beauty stole this idea for when they did the plastic bag scene, because I think that was out 4 or 5 years later. And it's basically the same, isn't it? But with a bag instead of a feather.
I've never seen that film, Andy.
Okay.
So when I saw your notes, I thought, I'm not going to Google it or YouTube it and see. But if it is a floating plastic bag, is it at the beginning, at the end, or is it just...
Do you know, I can't remember exactly where it features in the film, but it's quite a famous scene from the film. And I think it's been replicated or parodied numerous times, but it's it just reminded me of that. And but you know, American Beauty, I believe, was out in 99, so a good 5 years after Forrest Gump. So I'm assuming this is where they got it from. I could be wrong, but it was just the first thought that came to mind when I saw that feather floating around the screen. Now this takes us to the opening dialogue where Forrest Gump is at the bus stop. And he's chatting to strangers, and that's kind of the premise of the film, isn't it? He's at the bus stop chatting to various people about his life so far. The note I made here, if you talk to strangers at a bus stop these days, you're going to catch a beating, aren't you?
Andy, did I ever tell you how I met my wife?
You didn't pretend to be Forrest Gump at the bus stop, did you?
That's funny because, yes, I did meet her at a bus stop. I never met her before. And I literally got my tongue pierced the day before, so I couldn't really talk very well. So my tongue was really swollen. It was bleeding. I was like, trying to talk to her, like mumbling. and everything. And then I found out later that she went home and like spoke to her mom and said like some weirdo was talking to her at the bus stop. And then it was like during the summer. And then when I started college again in September, she caught the same bus as me in the morning. And then she was on the same floor of college floor, because the build, I think there were six floors in college where I went to. And we were both on the third floor.
So she thought you was not only a weirdo at the bus stop, but now you're a weirdo following her everywhere as well.
Stalking her, yeah.
So it's less a marriage and more Stockholm syndrome. Is that what you're saying?
But yeah, it is funny there. How far this is just chatting. Like, yeah, you don't really chat to people at the bus stop now. Everyone would be on the mobile phone, wouldn't they? I think she's reading a magazine or something, isn't she, as well? So we find out that Forrest Gump was named after an old relative who happens to be the KKK founder, from memory, as well.
Yeah, and this was a bit awkward to me, because the woman at the bus stop is a black lady, and he's telling this story to about his name, and I don't know. I kind of cringed a little bit.
Yeah, because he's just oblivious to it, isn't he? But yeah, it was a bit awkward. So you find out Forrest has an IQ of 75, which is below the standard entry to a state school. And the principal's showing like this little, I think it's like a chart, isn't it, with the little line, and it's showing where, because I think it's IQ 80, and I think he's just obviously just below it with 75. But that doesn't stop Mrs. Gump. She's determined, who sleeps with the principal, to get Forrest admission to the state school.
Indeed, this was a memorable scene. Now, I'm going to probably do this several times in the episode, and we might edit them out so you'll never hear it, but I love this quote. I just thought this whole scene. And so the principal comes out of the house, and Forrest is sat on the porch, and he'd been listening to what had been going on upstairs. And the principal says, "Your mama sure does care about your schooling, son. You don't say a lot, do you?" And to which Forrest just goes, which, was the replication of what he'd heard upstairs. And I just found that a hilarious scene. And I apologise. If we keep this in the episode, I apologise to anyone offended by the sexual noises that came from me.
I was going to watch this film with my boy, Andy, but there was this bit, and the bit later on where Forrest touched a breast for the first time, and I thought, do I want to sit with my 14-year-old son while these bits aren't? And I thought, no, I'm not going to tell him when I'm watching it, so I just watched it on my TAD. So yeah, I couldn't sit through that. But I remember watching this with my parents there, so that would have been awkward. So we see the first of many famous people throughout the film. So we see Forrest with a young Elvis Presley. They're together in one of the rooms, and it's alluded that Elvis copied Forrest's dancing technique, because this later see him on TV.
Yeah, he's got the awkward leg movement, hasn't he, because of the braces. But then it's time for Forrest to go to school, gets the school bus, and meets Jenny for the first time. And you would argue quite rightly that this is the moment that changes Forrest's life forever. Now, Jenny, as we find out, has got a pretty horrible backstory, and that will play into the film throughout. Forrest is completely oblivious to it. I believe there's, and I can't remember the exact quote, but he says something about her dad and how much he loved his daughter, how much he loved Jenna, because he's always kissing her and touching her. And it's one of those things. He doesn't understand what he's saying, but it's so sad. It's tragic, isn't it?
It is tragic because, yeah, it's obviously, you're telling the audience about it, aren't you? So Forrest doesn't understand. But that just reminded me, I'm sure Forrest says his daughters, isn't it? Not just Jenny. Is that right? I remember that?
Yeah, he might have said like his daughters, or he might say Jenny and Jenny and her sisters.
Yeah, hear about Jenny's sisters again, do you? So you know when she gets taken away to live with her grandma, I think. She's on her own, isn't she? So you never hear any mention of her siblings,
no,
do you?
It's a passing reference, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, let's lighten the mood a little bit. So when Forrest introduces himself on the bus, says, and I'll do the accent, why not? "My name's Forrest Gump." Question here, which is better? Forrest Forrest Gump or Bond, James Bond?
It's obviously Andy, Bond, James Bond. But I wonder if Bond would ever do the Bond, James Bond in a Southern American accent when he's undercover. That would be interesting to hear. Talking about kind of like iconic lines, we've got Jenny shouts the "Run, Forrest, run," which is, I would say, one or two iconic lines from the film. The other being, "My mama always said life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get." Now, I'm not going to try to act, you know, do accents there, Andy. That is just my natural voice there. And Forrest is being chased by three kids on bicycles when Jenny shouts that. And then later we see a very similar scene, but this time Forrest is older. He's in high school, from memory. And he's being chased by the high school kids in this kind of pickup truck. And then this is where we see the first American football scene, because there's a few throughout the film. And we see Forrest score a touchdown as well. But he continues running off the film because he doesn't quite understand the rules, which, to be fair, I don't understand the rules of American football either.
I've tried. it's not for me. But yeah, there's the scene where he first runs onto the field and then he becomes a footballer. But the coach, when he scores the touchline, another line that really just I remember and I think is great. "He may be the stupidest son of a bitch alive, but he sure is fast." A little bit of an accent there. I apologise to our American listeners. And I'll probably have to apologise several times more. But let's continue rolling. We've got a scene later on, which is one of the first, I think maybe the first American historic scene. So it's actual footage where Gump is kind of sliced into it, which I think is really clever how they do this throughout the film. You see Gump in the background while the Alabama governor, George Wallace, stood at the door of the University of Alabama, where they're trying to prevent black students from entering after the desegregation of schools. So, you know, monumental piece of American history, which Forrest Gump just happens to be involved in. And then later on, we've got Forrest meeting the US president as part of his college football team. Not for the last time that Forrest meets a president. And it's a funny scene because he doesn't really make much, you know, doesn't make much of a deal about meeting the president. It's more about the free catering and the free drinks. And he has over 10 bottles of Dr. Pepper because they're free. And then when he comes to shake hands with the president, he's bursting for the toilet. And I think, but, you know, the president says, "How does it feel?" And he just goes, "I gotta pee."
It is good. And Andy, I think even though this film came out, what is it?
29 years ago.
I still think, you know, the historic clips, they still hold up. I was really impressed, you know. It wasn't, you know, some films that you watch, you think, oh, that looks really, like, dated. I thought they were really well done still.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there was any, like, dodgy CGI or green screen moments at all, really, throughout the film. But yeah, these scenes in particular, I think, were really well done.
And I would be fascinated, and I haven't done this, and I always think about, I need to do it, to watch the original clips. Because I know later on when he meets John Lennon, you know, when the TV show that he appears on, John Lennon was with his wife. So they've cut her out and replaced her with Forrest Gump. But I'm always curious to see what the original footage was before, you know, they've put Tom Hanks in it. I was kind of intrigued to see what they look like. Moving on, Forrest joins the army and he meets Bubba.
Again, I'm going to add in some quotes here at this point because there's just so much memorable dialogue. I thought the interaction between the two and the meet was really good. And Bubba, as we'll find out, is all about the shrimp in life. And he asks Forrest, "Have you ever been on a real shrimp boat?" And Forrest replies, this may be the funniest line of the film for me, "No, but I've been on a real big boat."
It's a good line, Andy. During the army bit, there's lots of scenes, isn't there, Andy? Especially at the beginning bit, where it's basically Bubba just talking about shrimps and Forrest is just listening. So we see the bit where Forrest breaks the company record for assembling a dismantled gun. And the army life really seems to suit Forrest as well. And he finds out that Jenny has posed for Playboy. and he goes to the strip club to find her. But he doesn't collar on, does he, that it's a strip club. He's just gone there to listen to her sing. And Forrest and Bubba go off to the Vietnam War, and they meet Lieutenant Dan Taylor for the first time.
Yeah, this is a good portion of the film, this, particularly musically. So the Vietnam scenes has some really, really good songs in the background. You know, banger after banger after banger, as someone might say. Then we get to a scene where the platoon is attacked and Forrest runs to safety. But then he runs so fast that he's kind of on his own. So he goes back into the war zone and he's rescuing several wounded troops along the way. He's actually looking for Bubba, isn't he? But other soldiers keep needing his assistance. So he's just one after the other carrying soldiers to safety. However, he finally gets to Bubba, and Bubba dies in Forrest's arms. Side note, during this rescue, Forrest was shot in the bum, or the ass, as our American friends might say. Just a quick note on this section of the film. We've kind of skipped over a little bit, but it's not a long part of the film. It didn't take up as much as I remembered it, but the friendship between Forrest and Bubba, I think, was a really, really integral part of the film. It was a pure friendship, wasn't it? I've made the note, they're a pair of kind-hearted simpletons. But I seem to remember this being a longer portion of the film. I thought, because of the gravitas that their two friendship has. But it was actually quite a short part of the film, wasn't it, the two of them together?
Yeah, when I saw your comment there, Andy, I agree with it. Because thinking back, I just thought there was more in Vietnam. But I suppose, because Lieutenant Dan features afterwards, I'm thinking, oh, maybe it's the post-war that is more in there, not necessarily the stuff that's actually in Vietnam. And, like you said, Bubba isn't in it that much, actually, really. Obviously, as Andy mentioned, Forrest has got injured during the rescue attempts. And he's in rehab now. And during rehab, Forrest learns to play ping pong. And he receives the Medal of Honor as well. So Forrest meets the US president. This time it's Johnson. And during the medal ceremony, he shows the president his war-injured bum, or buttocks, I think Forrest calls it.
In the buttocks, wasn't he? That's where he was shot. He's in DC, of course, because he's meeting the president. And there's a speech going on, like a protest rally type thing. And he's just kind of wandering around and accidentally ends up on stage to give a speech. This is another really funny scene, and again, it's one of those quotes that stuck with me all these years. I'll say the first bit. I might have to cut this out or edit it, but basically the guy asks him, are you going to talk about the war? And Forrest goes, the war in Vietnam? And the bloke goes, the war in Vietnam? Which is a really good line, which I will censor. But the thing that really sticks with me is, so in the background, there's someone trying to pull the plug on the wires. So what you hear Forrest say is, well, there's only one thing I can say about the war in Vietnam. In Vietnam. And that's all I have to say about that.
It is a good bit. That is a good bit, Andy. There's so many good bits in Forrest Gump. And Forrest meets Jenny during a big rally in Washington, and as he's doing that speech. And he later meets members of the Black Panthers as well. So later on, we see Forrest playing ping pong again, and everyone is watching him, and they miss the moon landing / moonwalk. I can't quite remember which one it was that is being broadcast on the TV. And that's when he's just playing with himself, isn't he, with the table. I think the table's folded up, or he might be doing two-handed one. I can't quite recall which bit that is. Do you remember, Andy?
I think it might be when the table's kind of at an L shape, and he's just hitting it back off the other side of the table. It's like an acting like a wall, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't play ping pong at all. I just hate that game. So Forrest is really, really good at ping pong, and he goes to China to play. And this leads to the TV appearance that I mentioned a few minutes ago with John Lennon, who is obviously one of the guests as well. And Andy, I can't remember the talk show host, but I did read as part of the research that the talk show host actually helped film that. So it was the only historical clip that they kind of reshot with him, but then kind of de-aged him as well. So I thought that was interesting.
Okay, yeah, I didn't realise that. That's probably technology ahead of its time for 1994. But once Forrest is done with his TV appearance, he leaves the studio, and there's Lieutenant Dan in his wheelchair. He's a drunken mess, safe to say. And there's a scene, I don't know if it's the same time frame or whether it's just, you know, soon afterwards, but I get the feeling it's around the same time. So it's New Year's Eve. Dan and Forrest are with two lady friends, shall we say. And Forrest doesn't really want to partake in the action which is going on, if you catch what I'm throwing to you. And one of the ladies makes some remark about him being stupid, and Lieutenant Dan then comes to his defense, and you know, the party's over at that point. You know, Lieutenant Dan's trying to defend Forrest, and as Forrest is talking on the bench, he remarks, he didn't want to be called crippled, just like I didn't want to be called stupid. And it's quite I probably didn't realize it at the time, but you know, watching it back now with fresh eyes, it's probably quite a poignant line that is in the film.
It is, because, I know I'm jumping ahead here, Andy, but you know when he finds out about his son, and he's kind of like saying, he doesn't say those words, but he says something like, is he smart, or something like that, doesn't he?
Yeah, he kind of goes, is he smart, or is he, and kind of, he can't bring himself to say the word, but he's obviously thinking, I hope he's not stupid. You know, but at this point, I thought that was... there's quite a poignant line, like I say, and particularly where Lieutenant Dan was in his life and Forrest was in his. It was, really, really good stuff here by both of them. And we're moving ahead still. Forrest meets the president again. Third time, Nixon is this one, and he's talking about his achievements in ping pong. That's the reason for him being there. Nixon makes a comment about, you know, what hotel he's staying at, and... Forrest tells him, he's like, no, I've got a better hotel, I'll hook you up, sort of thing. Turns out to be Watergate Hotel, and Forrest witnessed the famous Watergate break-in, and he actually phones security, doesn't he, and say,
he does,
there's people with lights on down there. It's just something that they've taken and made it really trivial in Forrest's hands. Another great scene.
It is. It's... I love these little tidbits where the, you know, Forrest is just present, isn't he? So many iconic moments in America's history. Now, Forrest is later discharged from the army and he goes back home to be with his mum. Now, Forrest ends up buying a shrimp boat with, obviously, you know, he discussed this with Bubba, and he gets some money from the sponsorship where he said he used the ping pong paddle. And I think he said some words as well, I can't quite remember, but he basically, it was going to get $25,000 for doing this little piece of work with the paddle. And shortly afterwards, there is a funny scene where Lieutenant Dan is on the pier and Forrest sees him and he just jumps off the boat and it crashes in a nearby pier. And I always thought this was strange because I remember this happening, Andy, when I was watching it as a teenager. Because when they're talking, the boat crashes like behind them, but it's the angle is shooting kind of like from the right to left, but the boat would have been going to the right side. So I always thought that was weird.
Yeah, I agree. I think the boat must have turned around somehow. You know, maybe it was stuck on left and down or something on the steering wheel, but yeah, it's... it's arguably a continuity error, but I think we can forgive it. I've not wrote this in the notes, but again, I've just thought of another like interaction between the two. Because isn't this where Lieutenant Dan's says, "I've come to try out my sea legs," and Forrest goes, "But you ain't got no legs, Lieutenant Dan." Again, it's a funny line, but it comes from such a place of innocence. So Forrest is. You know, he's explaining the story and he tells the there's a guy sitting next to him now and he says that he owns the Bubblegum Shrimp Company, and the bloke's like, wait, you own the Bubblegum Shrimp Company? And then he walks off saying, oh, I've been sat next to a millionaire, obviously not believing him. And then the old lady who's sat next to that guy kind of shuffles up and says something about, oh, well, that's a lovely story. And then Forrest shows her a picture of a magazine cover of him and Lieutenant Dan. Because I think at this point, maybe she didn't believe him either. And then the look on her face, like, oh my God, he's telling the truth.
It is. And Andy, I know we mentioned this just before we started recording. So obviously we're based in England. I've never been to America. So I wasn't quite sure whether Bubba Gump Shrimp Company was a real thing. Or, you know, like, you know, they've done various bits with the historical bits and, you know, how Gump is involved with them. So the research shows that this is actually a real life company, and it was started after being inspired by the Forrest Gump film. So as of today, there are 34 restaurants across 8 different countries. And another interesting side note is the actor Chris Pratt, famous for playing Star-Lord in the MCU and Owen Grady in the Jurassic World trilogy films, worked as a waiter in the Hawaii restaurant. So Andy, when you go to America next time, you might have to check out Bubba Gump Shrimp Company. They have a lot of restaurants in Asia as well, actually.
It's funny you mention that, because when I was in San Francisco 19 years ago, I don't know if it was a Bubba Gump restaurant or whether it was a gift shop, but it was definitely Bubba Gump, because outside there was a bench with a Forrest Gump looky-likey, I guess you'd call it, sat taking pictures with people. And apologies, listeners, if I've told this story before, but it's quite a funny story. My sister was with me, and she wanted a photo taken next to Forrest Gump, and I'm trying to use her camera, and I didn't really know what I was doing. And Forrest Gump leans over to my sister and says, "Your brother is not a smart man."
Yeah, no, you've not told that story before, Andy. So would that be a different time you went to America and saw Jolie?
Same trip. I did, yeah, 2004. I had a few days in LA, a few days in San Francisco, a few days in Vegas, and a couple of days at the Grand Canyon. So I did kind of West Coast-ish. Back when I was still a teenager myself, only 19 years old. Anyway, let's get back to present day. We're talking about Forrest Gump, of course. He goes home from the shrimp boat because his mum's sick. She's dying of cancer. And this is not the first, but one of many emotional scenes coming up, where basically she's on her deathbed. She passes away from cancer. Forrest explains that Lieutenant Dan has invested the money into Apple, or a fruit company, as he calls it. So it means he never has to work again. He's got all the money he could ever dream of. And then we get the return of Jenny again. They spend the night together, but she leaves the following morning. Jenny's had a difficult life. She leaves Forrest again. And part of this, when they're kind of having this reunion, they're walking through Greenbelt, Alabama, and they come across Jenny's childhood home. And Jenny's visibly upset, and she starts throwing stones. And this was a real tearjerker, this scene, for me, because obviously it brings back memories for her of what her dad did to him. Forrest, you know, again, he's somewhat oblivious to it. But yeah, so she's had a tough life, but what a bitch. She's left him again.
It is sad. I got tearful on two bits, Andy. This wasn't one of them. I might have done, you know, in the countless times I've seen this film. The two bits was later on when he finds out he's a dad, and then the wedding with Jenny were the two bits that still made me well up a little bit. It's interesting because it's like what is happening with Jenny, because she's obviously, you know, she was abused as a child, and it's good because throughout the film, there's certain bits where, for example, Gump, when he's in Vietnam, he's looking at the stars, isn't he, or the moon, and then it kind of cuts to where Jenny is as well, and it kind of just shows you what she's going through. So throughout the film, it's not flashbacks, but it cuts to Jenny doing various stuff, and she's always in even an abusive relationship, or she's self-destructive. And it kind of makes you wonder whether the reason why she never stayed with Forrest Gump, did she kind of always think that she wasn't good enough for Forrest? You know, is that why she is like constantly running away and she's kind of giving him an opportunity to find someone that's genuine like him?
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think the only alternative, although it's kind of tied in, is maybe that she's worried she would hurt him by just being around him because everything she touches turns to crap, sort of thing. One thing I did think about, not only this scene, but various throughout, where you've got those kind of, I guess it's in parallel, isn't it? It's Jenny's life in parallel with Forrest as he's telling his story. Does he know what Jenny's going through? Because, you know, is he telling Jenny's story as well? That's why we're seeing the scene. Or is it just by the way, this is what's happening with Jenny in the background, and he doesn't actually know, and that's why he's so oblivious to things, because he doesn't understand the context. Either way kind of works, but I wonder if he's oblivious rather than he's telling the story.
I think he's oblivious just because the bit, we haven't mentioned this, but you know the bit where they're at university and she's kissing some bloke in a car? He's very protective. So I think if he was, because obviously she never replied to any of his letters, so I think if she ever told him what was happening, I think he would have just gone straight there to try to help her.
Yeah, I think you're right.
So for me, the whole film, Andy, so Jenny's left him, she gave him some trainers, and this is my favourite bit in the whole film. So Forrest goes for a run, and I just love this bit because it's just going, you know, over the time period, you see him running, his beard's getting longer. And at this particular point, it says he's been running for more than 2 years, and it's the fourth time he's crossed America.
So there's a couple of funny bits during these running scenes. There's a guy who's running next to him, and he sees Forrest step in some dog mess. So he says to him, "Oh my God, you just stood in that dog shit." He goes, "It happens," and that leads to the "shit happens" car bumper stickers, which are world famous. And then there's a bit where there's a guy with a yellow t-shirt running alongside Forrest, and then gets a huge splash of mud in the face from a passing car. So he passes him the yellow t-shirt, wipes his face, hands it back to him, and says, "Have a nice day." And you see the what is now iconic yellow smiley face image that goes with the "have a nice day." So again, just a couple of, not American history points, but the kind of pop culture references that he is supposedly responsible for. And then he decides, "I'm going to stop running." After 3 years, 2 months, and 14 days. So that's quite the shift he's put in there. I did have a couple of follow-up questions, though, on the running piece. So he does change his clothes quite a few times throughout the run, and I think he does say he just stops to eat and sleep. But where are his other clothes? And where's his wallet? Because he's got to keep buying these clothes and staying in hotels or motels whenever to sleep. I know he can afford it. It's not a matter of having enough money. It's just, where is that money? Is it on his person? And, you know, how does he transport it about?
No, the valid comments, Andy. I think he probably just literally just has the clothes on, you know, on him. That's it. I think when he needs to wrap up or wear his summer gear, I think it's literally he just goes and buys them, and then probably he would, you know, donate the ones to charity or just gets rid of them. I think maybe, though, in terms of the wallet, Andy, he's ahead of his time, and he's got something like Google Pay or Apple Pay or something, and he just uses his mobile phone to pay for everything. Or maybe it's cryptocurrency or something.
Yeah, in the late 70s, early 80s, as this would have been sat. Yeah, it would have been ahead of his time. That's true. Or maybe, as he's crossing America so many times, one of the stops along the way is just back to his own house, just to pick up some more cash, and then carries on running.
Maybe he doesn't know about ATM machines, so that's why he keeps going back. Like you said, he keeps going home to his little money pot or something. But as Andy mentioned, he's finished now. And Forrest goes to see Jenny, and we find out he's a dad to little Forrest Jr. And Jenny is sick, and she mentions that she has a virus, which I believe is implied to be HIV. But doing the research of this episode, and it's an interesting side note, that in the novel, she actually has hepatitis C. And Forrest and Jenny get married, and because she proposes to him, so they get married. I thought that was nice, because obviously she says no, doesn't she, early on in the film about marriage.
She does, yeah. I'm just going to jump in at this point. This has just come to my mind because I completely agree with you that it's implied to be HIV. But the timing, I'm not sure if it lines up.
I know, because, I thought about this, yeah.
Because as we'll find out soon, she dies. And the headstone says 1982 is the time she dies. Was HIV a thing in 82 or was it a little bit later than that?
I'm not too sure. I know it was the 80s. And she does say, doesn't she, that the doctors don't know. Because
it's one of the first cases of HIV, do you think, and that's why they don't know?
Yeah, but my query was, it was to do with a timeline. So, did she have HIV when she slept with Forrest? Or does she get it afterwards? But then you would say, if she got it afterwards... I took it that after she met Forrest for the last time, you know, before she got married, you know, before she disappeared, I thought he was more on the straight and narrow now. So it would be implied that it was afterwards. And also, I Googled this, Andy, because I wasn't too sure about little Forrest Jr. So there's only, based on very quick Google search, there's only a 5% chance of hepatitis C being passed on to your child.
Interesting, yeah. We're divulging into some medical section of the... I've just had a quick Google, and it says... So the first thing is from Screen Rant, saying she dies of hepatitis C in the book, while she dies of AIDS in the movies, according to Screen Rant. Notably, hepatitis C was discovered in 1989, which is why the doctors could do little for her, because it hadn't been discovered yet. So maybe it all plays into the unknown virus piece. But, yeah, apologies for the medical tangent there.
And I don't think there's a cure for hepatitis C, from memory. Let us know if there is anyone out there. And Lieutenant Dan arrives for the wedding, and we see that he has metal legs. So, obviously, you know, he's had sea legs, and now he's got metal legs. And he brings his fiancée to the wedding as well. And Lieutenant Dan is in a much better place now. And that's down to Forrest. If he stayed as the drunken mess that Andy mentioned earlier, he would have probably drunk himself to an early grave. But going to see Forrest and working on, you know, the shrimping boats has definitely saved his life.
Absolutely, yeah. And we get to the end of the film now. There's a few emotional scenes. Obviously, there was the one with Forrest meeting Forrest earlier, which was a bit of a tearjerker. Another tearjerker is when Jenny dies and he's buried under the tree. And Forrest is at the graveside, and just a heart-wrenching scene where he's, he tells her that he's had a child at home knocked down, and he's doing his best by little Forrest. And then the film ends with them waiting for the school bus, and little Forrest Jr. catches the school bus just much in the same way that Forrest did way back at the start of the film. And the white feather that we had at the start floats into the air to end the film. And we cut to credits.
The Rain Room.
Shall we get into the film proper? So, the film opens with a bank robbery in progress. My question here is, where is the sheriff?
That is a very good question, Andy. Very good question. But obviously, it's not a real bank robbery. It's just Andy playing with his toys. Sorry, Andy. I'm talking about Andy. You're not playing with your toys there, Andy. Do I need to call you Andrew in this, just so the distinction is clear for our listeners? Or, cause it's obviously not your birthday, but it's Andy's birthday.
It's not my birthday. I'm not playing with myself or my toys at the moment. but no, keep referring to me, Andy. It can be a little game of confusion for the listeners to see who you're talking about.
I think it's probably safe to say, Andy, I'm never going to be in this situation. I can't think of many characters called Jay, and especially with my spelling as well.
The spelling, true. The only one that comes to mind is And Silent Bob.
Yes. Classic. I love Kevin Smith films. So let's get back to Toy Story. Sorry, Andy, I digress. So Woody and the other toys come alive when Andy leaves his bedroom. Now, I think the premise of the story is great. Toy Story is great because I think this is probably what every kid imagines or wishes would happen when they left the room.
Yeah, it's really quite a fun concept, isn't it? But just kind of going off on a tangent a little bit, it's portrayed as if they're just leading a normal life, not necessarily having all kinds of adventures. Andy's the one having the adventures. And then as soon as Andy's out of the room, it's like back to normality, which I thought was quite a nice twist on things. But of the toys, Mr. Potato Head seems to be the comedian of the bunch. I didn't make note of everything that he said, but he did drop a few lines here and there, didn't he? A few barbs and a few jokes. Whereas Bo Peep, she's a randy little so-and-so. The note I made here is that she's definitely after some Woody.
crease me up. So you're like Mr. Potato Head of the Rating Room podcast, Andy.
I am the podcasting potato, yes.
So the toys are freaking out about Andy's birthday party, and they're obviously worried that they might get replaced. Now, Woody is very calm, and he's trying to calm the other toys down, and he does come to a compromise, and he agrees to send the army troops to do some kind of recon. So he's quite confident, Andy, that he's not going to be the one replaced at this point.
Yeah, I think it's quickly established that he's kind of the leader of the bunch, isn't he, at this point? And he's given a bit of a, would you say, a rah-rah speech? You know, he's that kind of, he's got that setup, he's got the podium and the microphone. But a little side note, on the bookcase behind Woody, when he's doing his little speech, is a book called Tin Toy. Now, I mentioned this earlier in the podcast, but Tin Toy is a short story. And it's actually a 1988 short film by Pixar, which won the Academy Award for Best Animated Short Film. And this was the inspiration behind Toy Story.
Nice bit of research there, Andy.
And a little bit of an Easter egg in the film as well, the fact that it was behind him on the shelf.
Lucky I didn't put that kind of little bit of trivia in your quiz.
You don't know what else I've researched, so be prepared.
I can imagine after your last 2 weeks of 100%, I can imagine you swatting up now between each recording just to maintain your 100% record.
Yeah, I've put the pressure on myself, haven't I? I guess it's worth pointing out as well to listeners of the pod that the quiz feature remains in season two, but we've got it as an exclusive bonus content piece, not within the main pod itself. So check out our social media website, YouTube, TikTok, all those kind of things for more details.
Indeed, Andy. Well done, yeah, because I totally forgot that we took it out of our main pod for season two. So yeah, well done there for informing our listeners. So yeah, as Andy said, check out all our social media accounts. So carrying on, one of the army troops gets stood on and they are injured. Now, this made me laugh because as a parent, you kind of always end up standing on the toys that kids leave around the house. So I thought that was funny. And obviously, you know, to give credit to Andy, he didn't obviously leave the toys there, did he? It was the toys on the own initiative have gone down there but got caught short there.
Yeah, but he's probably going to get the blame for it, which is going to be very confusing. But more along that theme a little bit later on. This reminded me of a bit of a Vietnam flashback. We've got a soldier down. Forrest Gump would have fitted right in with this scene here. Could have done with him running and saving all those soldiers. But back to the birthday party. Andy is opening his presents, and we get some odd presents, you'd say, from one of the other kids, including a lunchbox and some bed sheets. And I think, it might even be Potato Head again, makes some comment as they're listening in, saying, who invited that kid? Which I found quite amusing. The presents continue. He's got a board game. And then we get to the last present, which is attracting a lot of interest, both from the kids downstairs and from the toys listening in. It's probably the main present, you'd say, that the kids tend to get. And we find out it's a Buzz Lightyear toy.
Andy, as a father, Andy, and also when you were younger, did you get a main present? Were all your presents treated equally?
For Christmas, certainly. Yeah. Birthday, depends. I don't really remember many birthday presents, but I do remember Christmas presents, and there was always a main one at Christmas. Still is to an extent. But you know, it's just less exciting when you're as old as we are.
Yeah, just pants and socks when you get older, children. So Woody is swiped off the bed and he drops to the floor. Now, has he been replaced, I wonder? And Mr. Potato Head here is being smug to Woody about Buzz potentially replacing him as Andy's favourite toy.
He is indeed. We're introduced to Buzz Lightyear at this point. He's a modern toy. He's got an updated audio button, which is obviously opposed to Woody's old-fashioned pull string, and a laser. And I think Potato Head as well says something about him having laser envy, which I thought was a nice little one-liner. The other toys are very clearly impressed with Buzz. Now, Buzz himself, he tells the other toys about the planet that he's from, because in his mind, he's not a toy. He's the real Buzz Lightyear. And he says, I can't remember what planet he's from, but he says it's from planet such and such. And amongst the crowd, the replies include, oh, really? I'm from Play School, and I'm from Mattel.
So this is where Buzz does his kind of iconic catchphrase, where he says, to affinity and beyond, and Buzz announces this as he jumps to fly, air quotes there. And Woody says something about, oh, that's not flying, it's falling with style. We see also here that there's a nice little montage here where Andy's playing with Buzz Lightyear, and you got the music playing in the background, and you see slowly Woody's kind of merchandise drawings are being slowly replaced by Buzz Lightyear's merch. So I thought that was quite nicely done as well. And Andy ends up sleeping with Buzz now as well, so that he's obviously his favourite toy, and Woody's left in the toy chest, and he looks quite sad as he closes the toy chest for the night.
Yeah, there's definitely a hint of jealousy seeping through. Meanwhile, next door, we're introduced to Sid and his dog. Sid has a thing for torturing toys. He just does it for fun. Clearly, he is a troubled child in a troubled home, has to be said, but more on him as the film progresses. Now, Woody's jealousy is starting to come to the forefront, and he tries to get rid of Buzz. I'm not sure if he intends it to be quite as brutal as this, but Buzz ends up falling out of the bedroom window into the bushes outside below. Now, later on, we see Woody. What, does he get thrown out as well? Woody ends up outside as well. I don't know if you realise the error of his ways. I'm struggling to remember exactly how it all panned out. But Woody. No, Woody doesn't end up outside. Apologies. Woody ends up going in the car with Andy, because Andy's going to Pizza Planet, and he's allowed to take one toy, but he can't find Buzz. So he's got to take Woody as a kind of backup. Buzz sees this going on, manages to follow Woody to the car, hitches a lift, so he jumps in the car. I think he comes in through the sunroof. The family pull up at a petrol station, and there's a really good fight scene between Buzz and Woody. I thought this was really well done. Buzz obviously kind of cotton on what's going on, that Woody tried to kill him. So they have a bit of a scrap in the petrol station. But at this point, obviously, they're no longer in the car.
They're not. So what happens in the end is Woody and Buzz have to hitch a lift with the Pizza Planet delivery truck as well. So they shortly gain entry to the Pizza Planet building. And it's a very interesting building, especially for children, because they've got like an amusement arcade in there as well, which I'm trying to rack my brain, Andy, thinking whether I've ever been to a restaurant where they had amusements arcade machines in, which I don't think I've ever been in one. In the pubs in England, you kind of get a soft play area in some pubs and an outdoor play area. But I can't ever recall seeing the amount of arcade machines that they have. So I don't know if you've been to any more sophisticated establishments than I have, Andy.
Not within the confines of a restaurant setting. I think the closest I can think of, and when I say what restaurant it is, you'll know that restaurant is a term I'm using very, very loosely. But in the local Super Bowl, there are some arcade machines next to the Wimpy, which
there is, yes.
Is I mean, we're not sponsored by any restaurant names or chains, but Wimpy will never be one of our sponsors. Let's put it that way.
Now back to the film. So like I said, they've got entry now to Pizza Planet building, and Buzz, his attention's caught by this rocket shaped claw machine, and he climbs into it. But unfortunately for Buzz and Woody, Sid is there as well, and Sid goes to the claw machine, and he ends up winning the alien toy, which I don't know if there's a proper name for the alien toy. I don't know, Andy. but he also wins Buzz and Woody. Now, you can tell this is a fictional story, Andy, because no one wins on a claw machine, but Sid wins three toys. Not very realistic there, is it?
Especially since he only had two goes as well.
Indeed, yeah.
You never win. Ever. Have you ever won? I don't think I've ever won on a claw machine, and I've probably spent countless pence as a child.
I've never won on a claw machine, but I know in some places there are guaranteed wins, but it costs a lot more money to do than a normal claw machine. So moving on, we're now at Sid's house. So we see Sid actually tormenting his sister, and he swaps the head of his sister's doll with a dinosaur head. So I'm not very good with dinosaur breeds, so I couldn't tell you which type it is. But you could tell he's a mean bully, even to his poor little sister.
Yeah, I want to say it's a pterodactyl, but any listeners out there know the breed of dinosaur, or the make of dinosaur, that's not the right word. The
species?
The species of dinosaur, there we go, we got there in the end. The species of dinosaur that Sid transfers the doll's head from, please let us know, but I'm going pterodactyl. So Buzz and Woody, they're in Sid's room, and it's like mad scientist type setup, isn't it? There's various creations and weird experiments going on, kind of like Frankenstein and his monster. And Sid is talking to himself as he's performing experiments. I think he even refers to himself as Dr. Sid or something along those lines. And Buzz in the background has a funny line when he just says, "I don't believe that man has ever been to medical school."
You know, Andy, I just want to jump in here. This is the first kind of full-length animated film. So I think it's probably setting a trend. But this film kind of sets the I don't know if it's like the framework where animated films are targeted towards children, but also the adults as well. Do you know, little kind of jokes and like adult themes that go over the top of the kids, but adults would appreciate.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense, yeah. I'm trying to think, because obviously this is the first Pixar feature length, but going back to like the old Disney films, I can't think of anywhere that would be the case. I think this, like you said, this may be the first, or certainly one of the first instances where there's kind of in-jokes for the parents, as it were.
Yeah, and you find it quite common now, don't you, in films. Not all Pixar films, but in other animated films as well, yeah. By other studios.
Yeah, they certainly find ways to try and sneak in a few more adult laughs, shall we say.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So it's during this whole kind of scene that at Sid's house where Buzz finally realises that he is a toy after all. He's not the real Buzz Lightyear. But he wants one final go to try and convince himself that he is. So he tries to fly again, but he falls and suffers a broken arm.
So, Andy, this really hit home for me, because I don't think I really appreciated this when I was younger. And I read this as kind of a metaphor, or symbolizes a number of things. And I think it's accepting who you are. You kind of question your purpose in life. And also about accepting change. So I don't know what your thoughts were about this, but when I rewatched it the other night, I thought, oh, you know, it's really sad. And I don't know when you kind of accept who you are, if you ever do. I don't know, but I don't know, that kind of hit home for me, that bit.
Yeah, this is they're exploring some quite deep and meaningful themes here when you scratch beneath the surface, and this is exactly, like you said, one of those things. It's about acceptance and realization, and yeah, you know, maybe even depression in some regard.
Yeah, because I think, if I remember correctly, because I can't remember fully, he's watching a TV program, isn't it, or an advert comes on, which makes him realize.
It is, yeah.
It?
He sneaks into the living room, and there's the TV on in the background, and it's a Buzz Lightyear advert.
Yeah.
And the word toy is mentioned several times in the advert. And amongst all this, you know, depression and misery that Buzz is under, he's acting like a drunk down and out, isn't he? He's having a tea party with Sid's sister, because she finds him and dresses him up. But it's not Buzz Lightyear anymore, is it? It's Mrs. Nesbit. And I think Mrs. Nesbit's had a little bit too much tea at the tea party.
She has. And did you notice around the table that the sister has took off the dinosaur's head, but just left the doll there with no head? You can kind of see like a little stump where the head's supposed to be on.
Yeah, and I noticed that. Yeah, that's quite sad as well in some regards.
Yeah, maybe that's why Buzz is, you know, he's drinking for two. You know, the doll's not getting any, so he's supping away as well.
You could say she was off her head.
And the last is keep coming, because there's another bit where, I think it's funny, where Buzz throws Woody his arm, and I think it's something like Woody says, "Oh, can you give me a hand?" And then you just see the arm just land next to Woody, and I thought that was funny as well. And Woody does have a plan to save Buzz, but this involves the other toys at Sid's place, you know, coming alive in front of Sid, and that's all the kind of like Frankenstein's monsters that Andy mentioned earlier on.
Yeah, this is a nice series of scenes where it kind of plays out into the escape. And we mentioned Sid being a troubled child, but if he wasn't messed up before, he definitely is now after seeing what he saw. But we've got a happy ending on its way, it seems, because Woody saves Buzz. But they've got to chase after Andy, because Andy's, you know, he's not privy to all this. He's still missing his toys. And they're moving house, so he's got to chase after Andy and the removal truck. Get to the back of the truck. The back of the truck opens. It's not very full. And you made a note of this, and I completely agree. There's, what, maybe five boxes in there?
Like, there's not many at all.
Probably could have downsized. Maybe just a small van, or, you know, tie some things to the roof. Not enough for a removal truck. Where's the furniture?
Where is the furniture? Yeah. Because does it ever explain why they're moving, or how far they're moving? Does that ever get explained? Like, oh, we're just moving down a few streets, or is it like to another state? I don't recall if it's ever mentioned.
No, I don't recall it's mentioned or not, but I guess it's one of those for the conspiracy theorists, is it? You know, are they fleeing from a violent husband that's not in the film, or are they going into witness protection? Yeah, it could be all manner of things, couldn't it? But they're moving. Indeed. For whatever reason.
Indeed. Well, it's lucky they've got a space ranger to look after them, and a sheriff, Andy. Are they going into witness protection?
If I'm going into witness protection, I want a sheriff and a space ranger by my side, that's for sure.
I'd probably want Bo Peep, to be fair, but yeah, that keep me company. So later on, we've got more presents, and Andy can't quite remember. This must be Christmas. Is that right?
It is Christmas, because the soldiers are hiding in the tree, trying to figure out what
that's right. Yes, out. Yeah. So it's Christmas time, and we've got more presents. This time, it doesn't say on the screen, so he might have got another lunchbox or some bed sheets, but he receives a Mrs. Potato Head, so Mr. Potato Head will be happy, but also a dog. So dog isn't just for Christmas. So I wonder if the dog will make further appearances in future films. But Andy, before we kind of move on to the next segment, let's just have a brief discussion about some more things to do with the Toy Story franchise, because obviously we've rewatched number one, and I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I don't know if we're going to watch other Toy Story films in the future, but we're not doing other ones in season two. So Andy, you mentioned about Andy's dad. Now, he's never shown or mentioned in a Toy Story film, so the absence of Andy's dad is not directly addressed in any of the films, and it kind of leaves his character whereabouts open to interpretation. So Andy, you've kind of mentioned potentially an abusive husband, so what's your take on this? Why do you think Andy's dad is not there? Do you have a theory?
I think he's in prison. And the reason they're moving is because he's being released, and he's threatened to come visit them. So they're moving quickly, which is why they can't take their furniture with them, just a few boxes. So they're off to a secret location to escape the felonious father.
I wonder, Yeah, I don't know, because you could say, is he always at work, or does he work away? But it's never mentioned at all. And obviously it's Christmas Day, and to be fair though, you don't see them physically opening presents, do you? It's just what the army is relaying. So he could be there, the dad. Or does he have two mums?
Could be any number of scenarios. It could just be camera shy, and that's why he's not in the film. He's just out of camera range the whole time.
Yeah, maybe he's busy doing podcast and audio only.
Or he could be cooking dinner while they're opening presents. All manner of things could be possible. Let us know your theories for those of you listening at home. We'd love to know if you've got any advance on convicted felon, escaped prison, or released from prison. But until I'm told otherwise, that's the official line that I'm going with.